The final case for oral argument this morning is Helen Gilbert Appellant versus the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe Appellee. For the appellant, Gilbert, is Mr. Todd Epp, an attorney from Harrisburg. And for the appellee, Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe, is Mr. Roland Samp, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Epp, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Todd Epp. I'm an attorney from Harrisburg, South Dakota, and just wanted to say good morning and welcome to Sioux Falls to the justices and the law clerks and the clerk and to the assembled citizens in the audience and to my colleague, Mr. Samp. On behalf of my client, Ms. Gilbert, I want to thank you for taking the time today to consider this matter of her termination of her unemployment benefits, and more importantly, the consideration of her free speech rights, both under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States and under our own state constitution. I also want to thank the court for the courtesy of an extension granted earlier because of issues in my family, as well as working with Mr. Samp in that regard. And I think that lay people in the audience should understand that this is a marvelous profession in South Dakota, where judges, justices, and lawyers treat each other well when necessary. So why am I here? Why is my client here? When I was in the television news business, I had a boss who said, Todd, if you can't tell them what this is about in 30 seconds, then you can't tell them. So what is this case about, and what do I want you as justices to do today? What I think the case boils down to with Ms. Gilbert is whether the denial of her unemployment benefits under South Dakota Codified Law 616.14.1 violated her First Amendment right of free speech, and or her Article 6, Section 5 right of freedom of speech under the South Dakota Constitution. In the alternative, and I talk about this in my brief, and I know that justices like yourselves try to find non-constitutional grounds to try to find for a party if possible. I believe that the record is devoid of any evidence that my client's actions in writing her letter to the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe had any impact whatsoever on the operation of the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe. And I think under the review standard, that is clearly erroneous and clear error by both the administrative law judge and the circuit court judge. So I think on that independent ground that's non-constitutional, you could remand and either ask for additional testimony to be taken or remand with instructions to go ahead and pay Ms. Gilbert her back unemployment benefits. However you get there, my client, you know, basically wants her unemployment benefits from the time of her termination in August of 2004 from the tribe until her new full-time employment in March of 2005, plus any applicable interest, plus the cost to bring this action. What the case is not about, in my opinion, is whether the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe had a right to terminate Ms. Gilbert. We're not contesting that today. Also, it is not about tribal-state relations, as I believe there is a provision in South Dakota Codified Law, Chapter 61A, that puts the tribe here as in the administration of their unemployment benefits. I think it's also important to remind the court this morning that it is well settled that according to Abild v. Gateway, which was cited by the appellee, that unemployment benefits are designed to relieve economic insecurity resulting from the loss of one's job. Consequently, unemployment statutes are liberally construed in favor of the claimant. So I guess if there's a tie at home plate, tie goes to the claimant. If you want to take the easy way out and remand a circuit court for failing to make a direct finding that the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe workplace was indeed disrupted by Ms. Gilbert's letter, which is in the exhibits to, I think, both my brief and Mr. Samp's brief, then there are two approaches to otherwise finding for my client. The first way, and I think the most trod path in terms of free speech, is via the First Amendment in light of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Rankin v. McPherson, which is cited in my brief, which further refined Pickering versus Board of Education, which I believe Mr. Samp cited in his, and as further refined by our neighbors in the Nebraska Supreme Court in Cox versus Civil Commission of Douglas County. Now, I would argue that your decision in State v. Springer-Ertl which I believe most Mr. Samp and I both cite, 2000, South Dakota 56, starts in this direction of analysis, but doesn't provide quite the analytical framework that this case needs, because that case was not dealing with employment matters. I believe that the applicable case law and the line of cases that I've just mentioned show a two-part test. One is the speech that, in this case, Ms. Gilbert made and her letter to the Flandreau Sandy Sue, is a speech of public concern. Now, yes, you'll read in the letter, Ms. Gilbert talks about a number of issues about elected and appointed tribal officials. Some of these things are gossipy. Some of these things are very substantive to the operation of the Flandreau Sandy Sioux tribe. They are the source of things one reads every day in our local and state and national newspapers. They are concerning things like corruption, favoritism, incompetence, administration of the tribe and its resources, and so forth. As noted in Morris v. Crow at 1117 F3rd 449 from the 11th Circuit, which I cited in my brief, there are things that, quote, relate to a matter of political, social, or other concern to the community. Did what Ms. Gilbert talked about relate to a matter of political, social, or other concern to the community? Are some of the items in her letter personal about people that work there? Yes. But are there also of interest of the public? Yes. Even in Belk versus City of Eldon, I believe an Eighth Circuit case cited by the appellee, the case notes that, quote, speech that criticizes a public employer in his capacity as a public official also addresses public concern. So I think Ms. Gilbert's letter is certainly in that vein.
Aren't most of her complaints, though, dealing with personnel problems in her position as
super? And I think the record shows that she was not terminated for those things, but she was placed on various types of discipline for those things. I think the terminating factor was the final straw, if you will, was the letter that she sent. And I think then that, though I think it is somewhat difficult to divine in the administrative opinion and the administrative transcript, I believe that is the primary reason why it was held there was misconduct under our statute. And that's why she was denied the unemployment benefits.
Your so Honor. it's your argument here then that this letter is of public concern.
Yes, and the topics in the letter are public concern.
But even when you look at the letter, a lot of it, a huge portion of it, deals with the internal supervision or lack thereof and complaints about internal management kinds of things. Isn't that, I mean, what in here is of public concern?
All right, let me go to the letter, Your Honor. Well, the first thing right off the bat was the accusation made against her that she was a prostitute, and that's a violation of law, and that it was somehow that made her unfit for employment. Now, while a personnel matter and personal to her, it also, I believe, goes to her fitness to teach the children at the Flandreau Sandy Sioux or administer those programs. Obviously, the parents and patrons of the Flandreau Sioux tribe would have an interest in who is teaching or administering their students. I think if you go to the second paragraph, she mentions that the chairman is unwilling and neglectful in upholding the duties of the tribal chair by not managing the problems within the purview of his office. While that's general, I think that basically would be like me saying, I don't think President Bush does a very good job administering his administration, or Governor Rounds doesn't do a very good job administering the administration. Again, that would be, in an election year like this, I would think, very public and go to their competence and ability to govern effectively. If I can skip on, there is, on page 2, there's information about Deb Wakeman and about her qualifications to actually be the HR director. Again, vital resources of the tribe are being spent for these positions, and the health and well-being of the workers of the Flandreau Sandy Sioux tribe are in her hands, and whether or not she has the ability to do so. I think the larger point, Justice Meyer Henry, is that there wasn't really any analysis done as to the letter. I believe, in my opinion, as you will read the record from both the administrative decision, Judge Gienapp's decision, and the transcripts there too, that all the findings of fact concerning the impact of this letter and the type of speech are conclusionary. There was only one witness offered by the tribe, and if you read her transcript, Ms. Allen, in the administrative record, it's difficult, frankly, to ascertain what she is often saying. And so basically she is saying, did Helen Gilbert conduct misconduct? Yes. Did you think this was disruptive? Yes. There's no other evidence of what happened. And I'm saying, if you want to not go down the constitutional track, I think there is no evidence, let alone substantial evidence or preponderance of the evidence, of any sort of findings that what she did and what she wrote was disruptive, and an analysis of the content of that letter. I hope that, does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Okay.
I must say in candor, as I did argue before the agency and the circuit court that there were concerns she had personally about her employment as the tribe's education coordinator. I did also, at the trial level, at the court level, did make the argument about the public interest as well. So I just wanted to point that out and make sure that that was noted to the justices. The other thing that we would need to look at then is, what is the interest of the employer and how is it harmed? And I got into some of that with my colloquy with Justice Meyerkamp. Now, I noticed that Mr. Samp wrote several times in his brief that at the administrative hearing, I made a comment that the Flandreau is a small town and that everyone might know everybody's business. What I said from page 34 is that record, that everybody might know that there's an accusation that Ms. Gilbert was a prostitute. Anyway, whatever it is that I said at the trial or at the administrative hearing, this court has held in Tenunder versus Menard, 1997, South Dakota 62, paragraph 21, that an admission is limited to matters of fact which would otherwise require evidentiary proof and cannot be based upon personal opinion or legal theory. Thus, the tribe can't bootstrap something I may have offered as personal opinion about the Flandreau community as evidence of disruption. I was offering personal opinion at that point. Now, I realize further that Mr. Samp has argued in his brief that 616.14.1 sets up a situation where certain enumerated behaviors in the misconduct statute can cause denial of unemployment benefits and that to that terminated employee. My argument is that while that is what the law says, it is not constitutional when it comes to speech. It may be constitutional okay as to conduct, but not as to speech. And I'm saying that when it comes to speech, the court should follow the Rankin et al. Analysis. Now, obviously, there must be a balancing with the public interest of the employee's speech rights with the employer's right to a tranquil and productive work environment. But unless there is some evidentiary proof of what impact that conduct has on the employer, again, we're talking speech, not conduct, there cannot be a true balancing of the rights of the employer and the employee, and whether there is a public purpose to the speech versus the business interest of the employer. Now, again, returning to Belk versus City of Eldon, cited by the appellee, it does deal with an evidentiary standard. The Eighth Circuit noted that in cases where the public employer cannot demonstrate that the employee's speech disrupted the workplace, however, the court need not proceed to a Pickering factor absent exceptional circumstances. In Sexton v. Martin, we noted that some evidentiary showing is a threshold inquiry to the appropriate application of Pickering factors. Again, my line today is that there is no such evidentiary showing. Now, I also understand that Belt concerned the discharge of an employee for exercising First Amendment rights and not employment benefits. Still, I believe this is an analogous situation, and as it concerns free speech rights in a governmental setting, as Ms. Gilbert worked for a tribal government. And it points to the problem in this case. There is no evidence of impact on the employer, just conclusionary statements. Now, as Cox versus Civil Commission from Nebraska notes in headnote paragraph 19, even erroneous statements of public concern will be protected unless they are shown to have interfered with the employee's performance or the regular operation of his or her governmental agency. That's from the Nebraska Supreme Court. Again, under this test, which regards termination, There is no such evidence in the record, in my opinion, of such interference with the tribe. And as further noted in Head Note 24 of Cox, purely speculative allegations of workplace disruption are insufficient as a basis for disciplining an employee based on his or her statements regarding matters of public concern. And speculation, I believe, is at best what we have.
Who all testified, or what kind of evidence came in on behalf of the tribe?
Excuse me?
What kind of evidence, or who testified on behalf of the tribe?
I believe Ms. Allen from, I can't remember which department of the tribe, and then my client also testified. I believe we're the only two witnesses at the administrative hearing. And then there were documentary evidence of most of which is contained in either my appendix or Mr. Samp's appendix, the letter, the some of the record below with the Department of Labor, Unemployment Benefits Division, and so forth.
So you're saying the letter isn't enough. They would have to show further that that letter had some kind of a disruption or effect on the workplace.
Exactly. Let me put this another way. The employee speech under the current approach with unemployment benefits and misconduct in South Dakota is scrutinized, and I might say highly scrutinized, but the impact on the employer of that speech is not scrutinized. That, I argue, invalidates the balancing test as noted in Rankin, Cox, and Pickering. There is currently no scrutiny required by 61.6.14.1 of the employer, and that, I argue, is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. Now, let's get to the road less traveled, and that's the South Dakota State Constitution's protection of freedom of speech found in Article 6, Section 5. California has a very similar provision, as does North Dakota. I could not find any case law in South Dakota concerning the analysis of this, and so we're kind of in new ground here. The South Dakota provision in our Constitution says every person may freely speak, write, and publish on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right. First, I think the plain language of our state constitutional provision is broader than the First Amendment, which simply states in pertinent part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, second and more interesting, the South Dakota freedom of speech provision provides that the person, quote, must be responsible for the abuse of that right. And I know we have laws on defamation and so forth, and I'm not arguing that we shouldn't have laws on defamation. That's clearly established. Helen Gilbert has already been held responsible by her employer for writing the letter. She was fired by the tribe. And again, we're not contesting that. Now, the state of South Dakota is frankly, in my opinion, punishing her again, or at the least, taking away a benefit she had coming as an unemployed worker in South Dakota on the basis of what she said in that now infamous letter. So she was punished once, state of South Dakota comes and punishes again simply because of what she said on public concern. So if you find that the South Dakota freedom of speech section is more than precatory, in other words, is just
you have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. And has real meat and impact, what should its application be in this case? Now, I wish there was some legislative history. I looked through Justice Gilbert's collection of journal entries from the 1800s on our Constitutional Convention, and they talk about a lot of things, but not about freedom of speech.
But are you saying that there can only be one consequence of wrongdoing?
Well, where does that... But the difference there, Your Honor, is that that is conduct, not speech. There would not be any First Amendment protection to her stealing money from the tribe or state constitutional protection. I'm not sure. I think I would turn that around. The consequence here is borne primarily by the speaker And again, I think what you're talking about, and I don't mean to split hairs with you too much, Your Honor, is that you're talking about a criminal act, and which would have no protection as speech. This would have clearly, and at least I would argue under the facts, free speech implications because it concerns public matters of public interest and concern. Where does that punishment come to an end, particularly when it's sanctioned by the state? I don't know. I guess I'm asking you in part to help draw that line today.
Well, aren't you really challenging the tribe's anti-political activity provision? It sounds to me from your argument that that's your complaint, not a statute that benignly denies workers unemployment to people who are rightfully terminated.
Justice Entner, that's an excellent question. I think the answer would be that if that was not the finding by the administrative agency in this case, that yes, it was put into evidence that there is such a policy. We believe that the consequence to my client is on the basis of our state unemployment law, and I think the proper venue for an attack on the Flandreau-Sandy Sioux tribe's anti-politicking policy as being too narrowly construed would be in the tribal court of the Flandreau-Sioux tribe and not in the state courts of South Dakota.
Your time has expired, Mr. Epp. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Samp, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Epp. May it please the court. I think that there's some factual things that need to be cleared up regarding this particular case, and some of it is rooted in the governance of the Flandreau-Sandy Sioux tribe. The organization of the tribe under the Constitution is that it's governed by an executive committee that's elected and constitutes seven elected officials with a treasurer that's appointed. And that's the governance, except when the general council meets. By constitution, the general council of the tribe are all the members, and they are constitutionally mandated to meet four times a year to take up issues with the general council and whatever issues the membership wishes to take place. Secondly, I think there's just a bit of confusion in how some of the facts were laid out here. I think in listening to the argument and reading the briefs, what I had thought is that we needed to have a showing that the ruling of the administrative law judge and Judge Gienup in circuit court had to be clearly erroneous and that the burden of proof would be on the appellant to show that. And in Weiss v. Brooks Concrete, that standard is well set and clearly a part of the law. In order to overturn a decision of this nature, I believe the burden of proof is to show that there was a clearly erroneous finding, and that hasn't been made. The basic facts aren't in dispute in this case. The appellant does argue that there's no finding by the administrative law judge or Judge Gienup on appeal. We respectfully disagree with that. Both found that the actions of Ms. Gilbert constituted misconduct as defined by South Dakota law, and the court did not depart from the precedent set in this case. The appellants would ask you to depart from the precedent of what is the clearly erroneous standard. On the issue of the First Amendment right, I believe that's somewhat misstated. Ms. Gilbert did not raise issues about her job in her actions to be found to constitute misconduct. She rather went on a personal diatribe of grievances that she had with a litany of attacks, none that are related to her job. Mr. Epp, I believe, may have just misspoke when he said that she was concerned about doing her job as education coordinator. Her letter reflects that she was concerned about some allegation, totally unfounded, about some kind of gossip about her past which nobody believes to be true, but impeding her ability to run for office within the tribe. Now, that's a personal interest. That's not a public interest. And everything in that letter, as we go through it, and I'm not going to go through it today, but everything in the letter that you have before you, Justices, is personal in nature. And I think that's where Mr. Epp has a problem with this case, because he's trying to take the personal issues of a worker within the tribe, albeit she be a tribal member, and make that into some kind of a public issue so that you can shoehorn into the tests of Connick v. Meyer and all the cases that have come after that. Well, it'd be our position that those aren't public concerns, and I'd like to address that. And the way I would address that is this, Your Honor, that Ms. Gilbert, you could take that whole letter, and every one of the issues that she has with other people within the tribe. And they're numerous. Some are the executive council, some are the HR director, some are other employees, everything from casual workers that are members of the tribe. I mean, she covers with a broad paintbrush her objection as to how it's being run. The facts are that she was offered a suspension for this conduct and chose not to take that, and instead took a termination. She wanted to test the policy. I don't think that's hard to read into it, that she wanted to test the anti-political policy of the tribe.
Mr. Samp, her letter, as you have just indicated, has a lot of personal concerns about other employees and so forth. Yet the reason that the department and the and affirms, as far as the Santee Sioux tribe's discharge, was that she was engaging in political activity, which was against the policy. So how do you take those personal concerns that she has and turn them into political activities contrary to the policy?
Sure.
And then, as a piggyback on that, if they are political activities, then aren't they not protected by the First Amendment because they would be of public concern?
Well, let me respond to both questions in this way. The anti-political policy of the tribe has its foundation, first of all, in the Tribal State Gaming Compact. The Tribal State Gaming Compact that allows for the casino to operate requires that they have an anti-political policy. The tribe takes that very seriously because obviously that's a major source of income to the tribal members as well as to the tribe. So the political policy is in part, that's in the handbook and was agreed upon by Ms. Gilbert, is in part has its roots in a general anti-political policy within the tribe. They simply, for preservation of the workplace and compliance with the compact, do not want employees dealing with political activity. The political activity here is that Ms. Gilbert is objecting to the appointment of a secretary who's filling an elected position. So the previous secretary is elected, resigned, and Ms. Montoya is being appointed to that position. And she's objecting to that personally. She doesn't say it's bad for the tribe or bad for her job or harmful or anything else. She's got a personal thing going with Ms. Montoya based on some comment that was made to somebody 3 months prior to Ms. Montoya's appointment. And that's the conduct.
But she's not really doing, I mean, the language indicates that there's or suggests that there is, that political activity involves preparing, circulating, signing, soliciting signatures to petition for recall, referendum, or initiative, enrollment petitions, election petitions, or any other petition involving tribal matters or affairs. She wasn't really doing that, was she?
Judge, with all due respect, it's that last statement that they utilized for making a determination that there was a violation of the political policy. The point that I really think needs to be stressed here from the standpoint of my client is that Ms. Gilbert had lots of ways to remedy her personal grievances. If she didn't like the Secretary of the Tribe, there's a recall provision within the statute. She could have done that on her own time, on her own money, and while using company equipment. If she knew of alleged crimes in the tribe, there's a tribal prosecutor and the U.S. attorney. She didn't choose to exercise her right to that. If she knew of policy abuses, by constitution, the tribe meets four times a year, and she has a right, every right as a member, to bring up all those issues in a freedom of speech context and have those grievances aired. And just as she could have written the same letter using the same words on her own time, in her own equipment, and none of us would be in this court today. The thrust of the decision to find misconduct was that she deliberately violated the political policy and used, admittedly, company time, company stationery, and company equipment to carry out these personal issues.
Let's assume for a minute that her conduct constituted anti-political activity. In what way is there any, or what evidence is there that that in any way disrupted the Santee Sioux Tribe?
Well, the testimony of Cynthia Allen, the contract administrator, at the administrative hearing indicated that this was conduct that should not be allowed. There's two parts to that. We disagree with Mr. Epp. He made a judicial admission that in Flandreau, everyone knows everyone's business, and when you make an attack against many people, not just limited to the executive committee that might sit in executive session and deal with a personnel matter, but the attack was on numerous people, so that's divisive in itself. And secondly, she indicates herself that she's unable to work with the people that have been selected. And that's divisive within the workplace. And I don't know how far we have to allow divisive conduct to go in the workplace before we draw the line and say, no, within the handbook, you're in violation. You're now subject to suspension. The employee says, I don't want to take a suspension. The employer's left with two choices at that point. Either they can fold and allow this kind of contact to permeate the entire workforce, which is fairly large, or they can terminate, and that's what they did.
Mr. Epp argues that it isn't enough just to be divisive. It's got to be, you have to have established that it's disruptive, that it has, in fact, caused disruption. What evidence is there of that?
Well, first of all, his judicial admission that everybody knows everybody's business. Secondly, the admission of Ms. Gilbert that she couldn't work with the people that were now in charge. I mean, both of those things constitute being divisive. I did want to respond to the Cox case that Mr. Epp cited. If we don't have a issue of public concern, and I don't think we have here, I mean, I don't know how we can read her letter anything other than personal issues. because none refer to whether she can do a good job as educational coordinator or not. But the Cox case says if a statement does not involve a matter of public concern, the First Amendment doesn't apply and the inquiry ends. And I don't mind addressing the First Amendment issues, but I think that's what we have here. The first test, does this meet a public concern within the tribal community? The workplace behavior as being disruptive, I believe, starts with the test set out in Connick v. Myers, which has certainly been the cornerstone of the law in this case, and it's referred to numerous times in our brief. And the holding in Connick has been followed, by my count, 807 times in employment cases of this nature. And I would suggest that we continue to follow the precedent in that. The not following precedent leads us to the point of, you know, what kind of employment situation would we have in the state of South Dakota if every employee were allowed to conduct themselves as Ms. Gilbert tried to conduct herself without a consequence. And that gets me to the constitutional part of the argument, and that is where our South Dakota Constitution sets out certainly freedom of speech in Article 7, Section 5, but there's a part of it that's missing in the argument today. The part that says you have to be responsible for the abuse of that right. I think why Ms. Gilbert is in court is because she abused her right of freedom of speech, not because she used it. And because of that, I believe that counsel is asking you to depart from precedent and set up a new test under the South Dakota Constitution for this type of conduct. This court has already said, as you well know, that First Amendment freedoms have to yield to other essential values. I'd suggest that one of those balancing tests is to prevent misconduct in the workplace. If an employer can't take action to prevent misconduct, then the values of that go with the First Amendment freedoms are severely compromised. The
what did you think of his argument that that she's already been terminated for her conduct, and now by denying unemployment compensation, she's being punished twice, which is not proper under the constitutional claim he's making?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that being denied unemployment benefits is not a punishment. It's a legal decision as to whether you violated the law or not. The administrative law judge found that she did. Judge Gienup found that she did. So it's not punitive to say if your conduct has risen to misconduct under the statute that we can deny the benefits. And so that would be my answer to that argument.
So it doesn't matter that there's two consequences of her conduct?
No, I think any time you launch a diatribe like is in front of you, if it were to happen to any employer, that chaos would result if they were to allow employees to conduct themselves in this manner on company time, using company equipment, using company letterhead. And again, I believe that Ms. Gilbert was testing how far she could push before there'd be a consequence to her behavior.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. In our brief, we've tried to outline as pedantic as we can the various positions that I think have been properly addressed. I would just say that whether you view this case from the perspective of Wise, the clearly erroneous standard, whether you look at it from Connick v. Myers and all the other cases that have come through, and determine that her conduct was personal in nature and not public in nature, that we would ask you to find for the Flandre-Santee Sioux Tribe. The tribe asked this court to affirm their decision to terminate this employee and find misconduct and affirm the decision of the hearing officer and the circuit judge.
Thank you, Mr. Sand.
Thank you.
Mr. Epp, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Samp. I want to briefly address some of the points that Mr. Samp made in his argument. On the standard of review, I believe both Mr. Samp and I in our briefs talk about the appropriate standard of review. It's, I believe, a clearly erroneous standard on factual matters, but as to questions of law, they are de novo, and I would turn to Barons versus South Dakota Board of Pardons and Paroles, 2005, South Dakota 49, at paragraph 5, where an administrative decision is being reviewed by this court, and the court notes that it is well settled that our standard of review from decisions of administrative agencies is governed by SDCL 12637, citing Graycheck v. State, 2003, South Dakota 74. And then quoting from Graycheck, an aggrieved party or agency may obtain a review of any final judgment, that's from the statute, of the circuit under the chapter on appeal to the Supreme Court. And
is the finding that this was not of public concern, is that reviewed under clearly erroneous or de novo?
I believe, I knew you were going to ask that, Your Honor, but I believe that the case law shows that the finding of whether or not it is a public concern is a question of law and not a question of fact, and so this court would have the right to make that decision de novo. And again, I'll just let your law clerks look up paragraph 5 of that decision, and then they can look at it. But I think, and again, I apologize, I believe that is under existing case law, that they would have, that is a question of law, not fact. So you would have the de novo to review.
Mr. Rob, let me ask you a question. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that this is core protected speech. Because it's a matter of public concern. The content of the letter, okay? Let me give you that for a moment. Even if that's true, isn't the reason for the discharge, in this case, her conduct rather than her speech, in that she used tribal equipment and she engaged in this activity during work hours? That's conduct. That's not speech. Isn't that what she was terminated?
I believe any time that anyone would ever write a letter of public concern, there would always be conduct because you would be engaging in some physical type of activity, whether it's writing by hand or writing at a computer, putting that memo into mailboxes. So I think you can't necessarily separate. I think the conduct and speech in this instance are intertwined with each other.
Well, they are, but I mean, you acknowledge there's a distinction between conduct and speech.
Yes.
And in this case, the conduct for which she was terminated was using equipment, using tribal equipment, using that equipment during work hours when she could have written the same letter at home, and as I understand it, well, yeah, it is. She wrote it on the letterhead of the tribe. So we have three areas of conduct involved here that she could have certainly done in her home but she's being terminated because it was done for this conduct.
Your Honor, I don't mean to muddy the waters on this, but I think when she addressed the allegations about being a prostitute, that definitely had something to do with her current employment. So I think that, to put that on a memo with the letterhead of the Flandreau-Santee-Sioux would probably be okay. Now, whether we would be here or not if she had written this from home on her own paper, I don't know the answer to that. I guess that's another day for another court. I can't make that assumption as Mr. Samp has made. I think you've got to parse, and I think this is part of the problem with the statute, the administrative hearing and findings, and then the hearing at the trial level and with Judge Gienap's decision is we haven't parsed those decisions, so there is a lack of evidence as to impact and effect. Is there a dichotomy between conduct and speech? Yes. Can there be a place where they intersect and are hard to separate? Yes. And I would say anytime you write a letter, how can you separate the physical doing of that act and the physical taking of that paper from the speech itself? And I think since free speech rights are implicated either under a First Amendment analysis or under a South Dakota provision of our free speech provisions, that should be a heightened analysis. The other thing, Mr. Samp in his argument also said that one of the things that was brought up in the infamous letter was one's character to run for office. Now, what is more of a public concern than whether or not someone is suitable to run for office, whether it is my client or her coworkers or existing tribal people, or to hold office? And I mean, we're in the middle of an election right now, and I've been working for candidates and causes during this election. Frankly, that's what most of the election is about in most elections. What is the character of the people who are running or who may run? So what is more of a public concern than the fitness of people to serve or who may serve in an elected or appointed governmental position? I would say that is entirely what elections and public are about. That is what is in the media. That is what we talk about and what the candidates talk about about themselves and their supporters talk
about.
But
to a certain extent, obviously, in taking that employment, she is covered by the anti-political policy.
And I think there is a bit of a tension. Again, if I don't know what the statute of limitations is off top of my head for the Flandreau-Santee-Sioux tribe to bring an action on her termination there, we didn't pursue that remedy. The remedy that was before us was whether or not she was going to get her unemployment benefits. And, you know, we're only talking about $6,600. And in most of the cases that you all hear, $6,600 is peanuts. But to my client, who was unemployed for 8 months, with very little opportunity for work in Flandreau and was depending upon handouts from the tribe and her family and friends, that was the thin line between being tossed out on the street and having a halfway decent life. And so because of what she said, she almost got tossed out on the street, losing her home and her heating and so forth. So this has very much has real-world consequences, this whole constitutional analysis we're talking about. So if you speak up at work, if you write something at work and you criticize your boss and it's legitimate public concern, basically we're saying under South Dakota law, as it currently exists under the First Amendment analysis or the South Dakota amendment, the South Dakota provision, tough luck to the worker.
2 minutes.
I believe that either analysis demonstrates that there has to be some sort of evidentiary showing of disruption. There has to be some sort of analysis of that speech. A, is it public? And if it's public, was it disruptive? I don't think the record shows in this instance any of that. Again, my preference would be, as you hear this last case today and you caucus amongst yourselves, that you say remand circuit court, reinstate her benefits, any interest, and cost of this matter. I think the out is to say, at the least, under existing First Amendment analysis, that our unemployment laws requires something more than mere conclusionary statements and conclusions made at a trial and an admission by an attorney that I don't even think is an admission under our decisional law to say that you don't get benefits. Ms. Gilbert was punished once by the Flandreau-Sandy Sioux tribe for her speech, okay? Now the state is taking away benefits. It's another thing entirely that, yes, are there going to be consequences to her behavior? Certainly. She may not get employment. She may not get references. Some people may shun her and so forth. But that is private action, not public action. And here we have action by the state taken against her on the basis of what she said and on the basis that she provided commentary on issues of public interest of people in the Flandreau-Sandy Sioux tribe. And I would ask you to benefit, to reinstate her benefits. Again, thank you for coming to Sioux Falls and sharing the judicial experience with the citizens here. My thanks to Mr. Samp again for all the courtesies he has shown me, and thank you to you and your staff for all the courtesies you've shown during the course of this matter. Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Epp. This completes our oral arguments for the October term of court.